Civica Radio.
Escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, June 27th, 2025. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC_show, and of course live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on Los Angeles as we explore how U.S. law enforcement, including ICE, has received excessive training from Israel and how recent actions by the police following mass protests earlier this month mirrors the militarized conditions in Gaza. And so with us on the show today is Victoria Valenzuela. She's an independent journalist in California covering social justice and criminal justice issues. She has an article in the Real News Network that came out in January, but is still relevant today as it was back in January, entitled "Deadly Exchange, U.S. Sends Hundreds of Law Enforcement Officials to Israel to Learn Worst Practices from IDF." She joins us for the first time on the show today from Los Angeles. Welcome to the show, Victoria Valenzuela.
Hi. Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So I have to admit that I've been a little hesitant to cover this particular story because even as we have this conversation right now, there's still a lot of moving parts when it comes to ICE officials and this Trump administration doing all sorts of things to harass, criminalize, and marginalize the immigrant community in this country. And even this week, even today, as we record this conversation, there is word from Georgia, the state of Georgia, of a Salvadoran journalist being detained by ICE, which is a developing story as I speak right now. But that sort of segues into your article, and it shouldn't come as a surprise that there is a cozy relationship between the U.S. and Israel when it comes to law enforcement and overall militarization of police. We've actually covered this on a show here in the past. Yet it is interesting to see how facilitating this relationship and how it is being supported financially. The facilitation is what caught my attention to your article. So in the state of Georgia alone, can you tell us about the American groups that facilitate these brutal police practices? Because again, this is one of the things that really caught my attention in your article.
Sure. So in Georgia, there is the Georgia International Law Enforcement Exchange Program, which has existed since 1996, where they have sent officials, law enforcement, to Israel to learn surveillance techniques and repressive policing. And they've also had conferences here in the United States. They've had Israel officers here teaching the police, the law enforcement, repressive techniques here as well.
Yeah, absolutely. The organizations that you mentioned, and as far as the facilitators, include the Anti-Defamation League, the oddly named Jewish Institute for National Security of America, which sounds odd to me because you couldn't have like a Muslim Institute for National Security of America, not to mention the Georgia International Law Enforcement Exchange Program. Again, all these strange organizations that somehow have manifested in Georgia, but it shouldn't be much of a surprise in Georgia because this wasn't mentioned in your article, but the School of the Americas, for people who don't know, is based in Georgia, and it's sort of the original Cop City, which we'll probably mention later on in the program. So about 2 weeks ago, we saw large gatherings throughout the country in response to Trump's ICE raids on the same day as his military parade / quinceañera, however you want to describe it. But looking back on an article that you wrote in January and the connections made by protesters since then regarding ICE and Gaza, could you have foreseen a greater awareness by the public of these two issues being closely linked? I mean, I know the purpose as to why you wrote the article, but could you have foreseen since then how people have grown as far as making these two connections together?
Yeah, well, I think you're totally right to make that connection. If you go on social media, you'll see videos of masked ICE agents going after people on the streets and taking them away from their families, children screaming, parents being separated. And, you know, these are, Los Angeles is basically under occupation. We have had federal agents, ICE agents come here. They're staying at hotels all over the county, all over the area, even going down south towards Indio, of officers just staying at these hotels and then coming to Los Angeles to arrest people and take them away from their families. And so ICE has trained with Israel. They also share a surveillance technology. The border system is called Elbit, and that is something that we get from Israel. And so there is this connection between the Israeli military and U.S. law enforcement. They're trained. If you see with the protests, the law enforcement are kettling, which means like pushing back on protesters. And an advocate told me that that's something that they learned from Israel, kettling the crowd. And so, yes, there's that connection there. And we've seen this with Black Lives Matter. We've seen this with just protests in general, like repressive policing. And so now we're seeing it again in Los Angeles.
It's not just with these current protests or even with the Black Lives Matter protests that we saw 5 years ago. We're even seeing people, you know, completely armed with tactical vests and these AR-15s going to courtrooms now.
Right.
Even going to schools as well. And it just shows you the absurdity of how these things are sort of escalating out of control to the point of over-militarization. I mean, even the way it was before 5 years ago was over-militarized to begin with. And I'll say this, since we're recording here in Washington, is that even something as Pride Month, the Pride Parade Festival here in Washington earlier this month, made the connection between LGBTQ rights and the rights of the people of Gaza as well, which goes to show you that all these manifestations are seeing the same parallels as other respective groups as well. Now, in your Real News Network article, you cited Rania Salem, an organizer with the U.S. Palestinian Community Network, with the following, quote, U.S. forces take whatever is working in Israel and they bring it here and inflict it on Black and brown people, end quote. I wonder if you could elaborate on this statement amid the backdrop of a situation in Gaza that has become a catastrophe. And again, like I said before earlier, there are a lot of moving parts with regards to not only what's happening here in the U.S. with ICE, but also abroad with Gaza, because in Great Britain, they've actually banned a Palestinian rights organization, you know, from the country outright altogether. But again, I digress. So I wonder if you could elaborate on her statement with regards to this sort of militarization being inflicted on Black and brown people, as you said.
Right. So in the article, I quoted another activist who says that what's happening in Palestine, the occupation and the repression of the people, they call it the Palestine Laboratory because a lot of what's going on there is battle tested and then it's brought over to other countries. It's been brought into South America as well. And a lot of activists are saying that what's happening here is a deadly exchange of worst practices because it is perpetuating settler colonialism. It is perpetuating harm to marginalized communities.
So you mentioned earlier the issue of Israeli surveillance. So I want to turn our attention now to that of Israeli surveillance technology in the U.S. And to do that, I'm going to play a clip here from an interview I did last year with Professor Mark Lewis Taylor on Israel's role on the Mayan genocide in Guatemala during the 1980s. And I think this is relevant to not only what's happening right now, but also particularly relevant to the surveillance technology that you mentioned in your article. So let's take a listen.
This is why so much of Israel's surveillance technology and military equipment was used not only against the Highland Maya in Guatemala, but also against dissident urban intellectuals and students and anybody suspected of carrying out activity that might lend itself towards transformation of the fundamental conditions in Guatemala. You know, I cite the research being done on the basis of millions of pages, literally millions of pages of records found in the Guatemalan precinct basement showing the peoples interrogated and the surveillance equipment necessary for finding these people was incredibly sophisticated and again provided by Israel. The end results of all of this, I thought this was so interesting. In Guatemala, a number of officials will refer to the end result of all of this in Guatemala as Palestinianization.
Yes.
The Palestinianization of the land after massacre and under and for conditions of pacification, meaning repression and dampening down any resistant spirit. So Israel is deep into it in a global way. What we see through the lens of Guatemala and Israel and the United States, I think, is a seeing into of a global pacification process in which Israel and the United States are playing a key role in order to tamp down resistance, to make walls, invisible ones and not so visible ones, and very visible ones. Todd Miller, another journalist, writes about, I don't cite him in this article, but he's very informative in writing on what he calls the border industrial complex. And that building of borders, again, visible and invisible borders, is a specialty of Israeli and U.S. technology together, and it's instrumental to the pacification strategy.
So that was Mark Lewis Taylor, who we interviewed last year on the show with regards to Israel's role in the Mayan genocide in Guatemala during the 1980s. And even then in the 1980s, he was referring to the surveillance technology that Israel lent to the dictatorship in Guatemala during that time. And I bring this clip up because it goes to show you that what's taking place in Israel is something that does not happen in a vacuum. And that includes the exchange of technology to marginalize indigenous groups in this case. And so it's just as relevant today as it is back then. And it's interesting because obviously the technology today is not the same as that of the 80s. So in addition to using police tactics, can you tell us about the use and interchange of technology by Israel and the U.S. in terms of surveillance, predictive policing software, which is an odd term, forensics, and AI facial recognition, and how these exchanges are not exclusive to the current Trump administration. Because I think you mentioned Cellebrite and Elbit Systems earlier, and some of those things have been interchanged during the Biden administration. And if we stretch it back to the 1980s, as we just did, it goes back to the Reagan years. A lot of administrations have gone back and forth with this unique interchange of technology with Israel.
Sure. So in addition to repressive tactics, advocates say that U.S. and Israeli forces both make use of surveillance techniques and technology that is Israel-based, like Cellebrite or predictive policing software, like software provided by Palantir. So in 2014, the Baton Rouge Police Department out of Louisiana took a trip to Tel Aviv, which was funded by a government grant, the Jewish Federation, and other private entities to go tour Cellebrite, to go learn about Cellebrite so that they can bring it back to Louisiana and they can use that on the Black and brown people who are living there. And Cellebrite was tested on Palestinians before it became more widespread. And so that, again, goes back to what Anthony Lowenstein calls the Palestinian laboratory. It was used on Palestinian, and now Israel is selling this and exporting it to the rest of the world to use on indigenous people and marginalized communities. And so there have been some communities who have been fighting back against this. New Orleans was, I believe it was New Orleans, who was successful in fighting against this and getting a ban on facial recognition back in 2020. But parts of it was reversed in 2022, but ultimately they're still working towards that. And that kind of also shows how groups are coming together to fight back against this.
Precisely. And I'm glad that you mentioned the issue of facial recognition when it comes to Black and brown people, because if you remember, during the Biden administration, there was a lot of criticism with regards to the CBP One app, which was intended to have asylum seekers schedule an appointment for asylum over the phone with this app. And what was discovered afterwards is that Black people are more likely to be misidentified by facial recognition technology. And we should also point out that Human Rights Watch and other human rights organizations mentioned that the very existence of a CBP One app to apply for asylum over the phone was essentially a denial of people's rights to seek asylum as well. Now, going back to the issue of Los Angeles, in your article, you stated that the LAPD chief and deputy chief also traveled to Israel for multiple trainings. I wonder if you could elaborate on this part, because it's certainly, in my opinion, based on what I saw on the news, you could probably tell me a lot better since you're in Los Angeles, and I would imagine that you were a better eyewitness to some of the things that happened. If you could elaborate on this unique interchange between the LAPD and Israel as far as LAPD officials going training, not just police officers, but higher ups as well.
Sure. So between 2002 and 2009, LAPD chief and deputy chief traveled to Israel for training multiple times. The deputy chief was actually part of the JINSA's first cohort to travel to Israel for this exchange program. And JINSA is a group where they also host training here for law enforcement. They had a training in Florida last November, I believe, and they actually had an Israel occupational force officer or commander as a speaker. So they have this relationship. And LAPD was one of the first to participate in this exchange program that they had. And so fast forward to now with the protests, you can see a lot of repressive policing. I actually just met a journalist on Sunday who was shot by police while taking pictures of the protests. They're shooting journalists. They're showing up to peaceful protests and riot gear with masks. And this is something that is intimidating protesters. They're peaceful protesters. They're there with their families. They're waving Mexican flags. They're dancing. They're singing. You know, there's coloring stations. Like, these are very peaceful protests. And then the police are showing up with this riot gear and with their batons, launching less lethal weapons, showing up on horsebacks. And so you can see there's that repression there. There's that trying to intimidate the community. And so, yes, you can see how LAPD, there's a connection.
Yeah, there is that viral video of the Australian reporter who was shot in the leg with a rubber bullet by who knows who it was. Could have been the National Guard, could have been LAPD, it could have been ICE. We're not really entirely sure with that video, but from what you're telling me right now, that wasn't the first time that a reporter was shot by law enforcement, in this case, in the last 2 weeks, correct?
Right. So I've actually heard that there are multiple journalists who were impacted by this, and I'm not sure where I've seen that, but I did see something like that, yeah. And then
incredible.
I also heard, yes, that first account of how somebody was shot by the police when they had their camera out.
Incredible. And again, I cannot stress this enough, that there are still a lot of moving parts in the story. And there are some other things here that may seem like secondary towards the bigger issue at hand that we're discussing here, but I think it's worth mentioning either way. And a lot of people who have been criticizing demonstrators, one of the things that they sort of like narrowed on is demonstrators bringing flags, you know, to demonstrations. I've seen the Mexican flag, I've seen the Salvadoran flag, I've seen all sorts of other flags during the course of these protests. And what's interesting to me is that I don't know why people have tried to twist the English language upside down and bend themselves into a pretzel to believe that carrying a flag is somehow a form of invasion or somehow a form of intimidation or anything like that, you know? And I'm curious to get your thoughts on this, because it's always puzzled me that even something as so much as a flag being carried by people that look like you and me, it's still somehow a threat to people who have been very supportive of law enforcement during this time. It's absurd to me.
Right. And I've seen that. I don't agree that it should be controversial, but I have seen people debate whether we should hold a Mexican flag, whether we should hold an American flag. I've seen people holding flags that are like cut in half diagonally and half of it's American flag, half of it's Mexican flag. But I don't think that it's a problem that people are holding Mexican flags. I think it's a beautiful thing. People are saying, you know, they're proud of their heritage. A lot of the people protesting are protesting for their parents, for their family members. And they're protesting for the people who made sacrifices to be there, because they either made a sacrifice or their parents made a sacrifice to be there. They're saying, I'm proud of my roots and I know where I come from. And it's a beautiful thing to have this. You know, you come to this country and you make a living, you make a life for yourself. And, you know, they're saying that they're proud of that.
Yeah, precisely. And I don't see why people think it's wrong to wave the Mexican flag in a place that's called Los Angeles.
Right.
As well. So there is another developing story that I wasn't planning on speaking to you about, but I'm curious to know as well, since you are in Los Angeles, as I said earlier, that ICE has even manifested itself in some, in my opinion, odd places, one of them being Dodger Stadium. And it dawns on me, as I have this conversation with you since you're in LA, is that it just adds another chapter to this interesting history of Dodger Stadium, specifically Chavez Ravine, of how it's a new chapter in how the city, or at least law enforcement, has tried to kick Latinos out of a specific area. And of all places, this specific area, Dodger Stadium, considering the dark history of Chavez Ravine almost a century ago. And I'm curious to know if you recognize that sort of irony as well with this.
Right. No, I didn't think about that connection, but I agree. There is irony there and there is that connection. Yes, the Los Angeles Dodgers did displace a lot of Latinos, primarily Mexicans, when they were building their stadium. And I know that the Dodgers have been a big point of controversy now with everything that's going on with ICE. I know there was controversy when they asked Neza not to sing the national anthem in Spanish.
Yes.
And she did it anyway. Yeah. And there was some controversy about whether or not she was allowed to come back. But regardless of that, she was asked not to sing it in Spanish when most of the Dodger fans are Latino. Dodgers are a big part of Los Angeles, a big part of the Latino community here. And a lot of that's their fan base. And so for them to say that, it's just very shocking. And then the Dodgers, I believe, did come up with a statement. But I believe the Dodgers did prevent ICE from entering their facility this weekend or like recently. They didn't allow ICE into the parking lot and they did make a comment. Some people were saying that this came a little too late, that they were upset that the Dodgers didn't speak out sooner. about the ICE raids and how it's impacting the community. And so there was actually, I seen protests. Somebody wanted to boycott the Dodgers. So there was like a protest to boycott the Dodgers here in Los Angeles because they didn't speak out soon enough. And so, yeah, you can see the community really wants to be supported right now. And they're supporting each other. They feel like they didn't get that support from the Dodgers, at least not right away.
I completely forgot that part about the national anthem being sung in Spanish.
Right.
Because that's almost like the Mexican flag thing that I mentioned earlier, that the very thought of a flag waving is sort of a symbol of an invasion. And I think some people, especially right-wing types, thought that singing the national anthem in another language is a form of invasion. Again, it sounds absurd, but we are living in very absurd times, considering, you know, what people are trying to do right now to get people deported. And again, even as we have this conversation now, I think there's another story about the wife of a U.S. Marine being detained while she was breastfeeding in a court. Again, so many moving parts right here.
Right.
But I want to go back to focus on your article here with the Real News Network. And let's go back to Georgia, because there is Cop City.
Right.
This project called Cop City in the Atlanta area, which has actually for almost 2 or 3 years now, has seen a lot of resistance from locals with regards to the construction of this project over in Atlanta. And again, knowing Latin American history, there is the School of the Americas not that far from Atlanta in the state of Georgia, which has essentially been doing for generations now what Cop City is trying to intend to do when it is completed. And so I just want to bring that up again because it is worth mentioning. Actually, you described it in your article as Little Gaza, or at least one of the activists mentioned it as such, right?
Right. So one of the activists had told me that in Israel, there was a mock city that they called Little Gaza, that they would practice repressive policing techniques and they would basically battle test weapons and other surveillance techniques in that area. And so Atlanta had, you know, recall Georgia, there's this program where police get sent to Israel, and that's something that like they're getting training from. So then in that area, they bring in Cop City, which is supposed to be like Little Gaza, a mock city where police can practice repressive techniques. And then this is getting replicated in about 80 other areas across the country. There's 80 other Cop Cities. And so, yes, there is pushback against this. A lot of activists in the area are pushing back. They're saying, no, I don't want a Cop City. I don't want more funding for police. I want more resources for mental health, for housing, for medical health care, for other things that they feel like benefit the community. A lot of these facilities are being built in marginalized communities or around them, and they're saying they don't want the funding to go there. They want things that are going to benefit their community, and they're against having more funding for police. And so, yes, Atlanta, that was a big one, but there's been some before that, after that. There's this website called Is Your Life Better? And that tracks all the Cop Cities across the country. And so I would recommend people check that out.
Yeah. And it occurred to me upon reading the article that there are already copycats of Cop City before the actual Cop City in Atlanta is completed. And that's already on top of the over-militarization that we've been seeing in the last few weeks with these demonstrations. So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Victoria Valenzuela. She's an independent journalist in California covering social justice and criminal justice issues. Her January article in the Real News Network is entitled Deadly Exchange, U.S. Sends Hundreds of Law Enforcement Officials to Israel to Learn Worst Practices from IDF. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Pintarles un cuadro con palabras, esta primera mancha que algunos llaman patria es la fachada que pusieron los criollos para que todo el pueblo defienda sus monopolios. Expoliaron nuestras tierras, nos metieron en reservas, fueron las manos morenas las que hicieron sus riquezas. No nos dejan sentarnos a su mesa, sin embargo, porque oligarcas quieren ver todo de blanco. Con cloro han intentado lavar la sangre, se olvidan que esas huellas son imborrables, aunque intenten blanquear nuestra memoria. La historia verdadera está escrita en tinta roja. Destrozan el paisaje con el gris de sus ciudades, sus negras intenciones buscan cómo opacarte. Nos ponen uniforme, quieren que seamos iguales, parte de su manada como seres impensantes.
Por eso lleno de color la ciudad, para demostrar que estamos acá, que luchamos por la alegría, que dibujando hacemos rebeldía. Yo quiero hacer flores en la primavera, y cuando huyo tu mirada hacia afuera, mires mi obra de arte en un muro, y que sonría por un momento tu mundo.
Tu mundo ha sido modelado por el miedo, te ocultas tras las rejas y tras armas de fuego. Color marrón han embarrado tu confianza, amarillo paranoia, otra vez la ambulancia. La constancia en la represión hacia el conocimiento, la ignorancia inculcada por la tele y los medios, son el terror con que nos tienen dominados. La violencia es heredada, la traemos del pasado. Les ha pasado que ven todo en blanco y negro, que no saben si su país es realmente un cementerio. A mí me pasa que me siento en una finca y los señores feudales ya me tienen en la mira. Porque pinto con pinceles sus paredes, porque mi poesía al poder no se vende, porque ellos me dan muerte y yo grito vida, ellos capitalismo y yo grito anarquía.
Por eso lleno de color la ciudad, para demostrar que estamos acá, que luchamos por la alegría, que dibujando hacemos rebeldía. Yo quiero hacer flores en la primavera, y cuando huyo tu mirada hacia afuera, mires mi obra de arte en un muro, y que sonríe por un momento tu mundo.
Rebeca Lane, Rebeca Lane. Cesari produce arte por la resistencia.
Por eso lleno de color la ciudad, para demostrar que estamos acá, que luchamos por la alegría, que dibujando hacemos rebeldía. Yo quiero hacer flores en la primavera, y cuando huyo tu mirada hacia afuera, mires mi obra de arte en un muro, y que sonríe por un momento tu mundo.
That was Rebeca Lane, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about ICE learning from Israel with Victoria Valenzuela, who's an independent journalist in California covering social justice and criminal justice issues. The article in the Real News Network from January is entitled Deadly Exchange, U.S. Sends Hundreds of Law Enforcement Officials to Israel to Learn Worst Practices from the IDF. And so, although not mentioned in your article, what are your thoughts on people drawing more attention to the use of masks by ICE officials when carrying out various arrests? In the last 2 or 3 months here on this show alone, a couple of guests have also brought this issue up, and they've had various degrees as to why this is problematic. And I'm curious to know, since you're covering the demonstrations in Los Angeles at the grassroots level, I'm curious to get your thoughts on this as well.
Right. I think it's terrifying for the community. You have mass ICE agents coming out of unmarked car, grabbing people, sometimes without a warrant, and just, you know, taking them, sometimes using force. And I think it's definitely intimidating to the community. And there's actually a bill in California right now that's going through legislature that would ban the use of law enforcement using masks. So you're seeing that this issue is getting recognition from officials that this is, like, you know, a problem. And so, yes, but I think it's very terrifying and very, like, militaristic that you have people with vests, with weapons, with masks coming and taking people. It's very scary for children who, you know, they see this and they see their parents getting taken away, and people who, you know, they're everyday people. People are showing up. ICE agents are showing up in workplaces dressed like this. People are showing up to courts dressed like this. And so that's very intimidating. And I just did a story too with USA Today about how domestic violence survivors are afraid to go to courts and call the police because they're afraid that ICE is going to get involved. And so you see these very vulnerable communities like straying away from calling law enforcement, from going to community courts because they're afraid of ICE. And so it's creating this terror in this community about, you know, seeing these masked agents. And yeah.
It is problematic because it opens a Pandora's box for other things, such as people impersonating law enforcement. It hasn't been that long ago where we had the story of two Michigan lawmakers or one Michigan lawmaker being shot and killed by somebody who was impersonating a police officer. And so this is a very dangerous precedent. And I feel like this is a 1-hour conversation in and of itself of ICE officials or law enforcement in general using masks, especially, you know, in very recent times, you know, in order to grab people, as you said, out of unmarked vehicles, you know, just taking people off the street. We have this story of the college student in Massachusetts about a month and a half ago being abducted in the middle of the street. So again, so many moving parts here that it's hard to keep up. Now, in addition to everything that you've written for the Real News Network, you have another article for a website called Waging Nonviolence, which you wrote in February on how Los Angeles could lead the way in resisting Trump's mass deportation agenda. I wonder if you could elaborate on the narrative in this article and how young people in particular are leading the way. I know that you spoke to a lot of young people in this article. I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit more and tell us about some of the people that you had the opportunity to speak with for this article.
Right. So I want to start by saying that Los Angeles has a very rich history of activism, Chicano activism here. And we have the Zoot Suit Riots. We have the East LA walkouts, the Chicano blowouts. The founding of the Brown Berets was here. And so Los Angeles already has this very big foundation of activism. And so this goes even before the ICE raids to when Trump was first inaugurated. There was protests in the streets. A bunch of people gathering, people from the community showing up and with holding signs that say Lucha Trump, fight Trump. And so, you know, there's this big resistance and this has been going on since inauguration. This picked up after the ICE raids. People took to the streets. There's been protests almost every day. There's protests nightly at the hotels ICE is staying at. There's a big resistance to this, and a lot of the students are leading the way, as they were with the East LA walkouts. Children were, after Trump's inauguration, walking out of their classrooms and joining the protests, leading protests under the mentorship of other activists who had been involved in this work for a long time. And so a lot of this is very led by youth even. I seen that there were protests on Roblox. Like, that's another example of how youth are leading the protests, you know. They're joining on the virtual servers, taking to the virtual streets and waving virtual Mexican flags, holding up signs that say like F ICE. And that's just how the next generation is. I think because we have social media, we have TikTok, we're able to post flyers for protests. Everybody's showing up. Youth are seeing these flyers on their social media, their Instagram, their TikToks. So they're showing up to these protests and they're also sharing videos of people getting torn from their families. They want to do something. They're not just going to take this. And that's what I love about Los Angeles. Like, we're not going to stand back and let people be ripped away from our communities. We're going to fight back. We're going to go into the streets. We're going to hold up signs. And we're going to, you know, let the world know that this isn't okay. And so that's something that I really admire about Los Angeles, just like the resistance, the resilience. And, you know, we're setting this precedent that, you know, we're not going to take this.
Yeah. And thank you for sharing that rich history, as you mentioned, with regards to Los Angeles when it comes to popular resistance. Because, well, the impression that I got from that particular article is that the older generation that lived through the Chicano walkouts, as you mentioned, are recognizing what the kids of today are doing.
Yes,
they're mentoring. Pretty much the same as what they were doing in the past, correct?
Yes, they're mentoring them. They're walking alongside them. They're giving them signs. They're giving them megaphones. So they're helping this next generation come up and really lead the way in protesting.
Precisely. Absolutely. You know, I want to go back to your Real News Network article, because the thing that bothers me about the surveillance technology that Israel is exporting here to the U.S. is that, from my impression, especially when it comes to the case of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, is that it's not accurate. It's not really working the way that they say or the way it's sold to government officials, because as we know with the case of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, he was sent to the Sikar prison on an administrative error that the Trump administration themselves admitted to. It's not like you and I said that there was an administrative error. They admitted to it as such.
Right.
And so it makes me wonder, to a certain degree, like, this technology at first glance may be selling, you know, government officials a bullet of goods, but maybe that's the intent, that the bug is actually the feature here. And from the impression that I got from your February article, that children are recognizing that sort of the same way in Los Angeles. Correct me if I'm wrong, if you like.
Yeah, I think it's terrible. I think these surveillance technologies, facial recognition, they're not accurate all the time. They're very faulty, and they put people from marginalized communities, especially Black and brown people, at risk even more of being arrested, detained, wrongfully arrested. And I think, yeah, they're not, yeah, I don't think they're accurate.
I don't think accuracy is even the intent on this technology. And I would say that, going back to what I played earlier with regards to the Guatemalan genocide, that that was the intent as well. So, you know, with the backdrop, and I think this is unavoidable as we have this conversation, but with the backdrop of an escalating war in the Middle East by the U.S. and Israel, who knows what will happen between now and when this recording comes out. But I'm curious to know, what else do you hope people learn from your article, from the Real News Network, that still remains, in your opinion, relevant today as we had this conversation? Again, lots of moving parts. But again, the reason I have you on is because your article from way back in January is just as relevant now as it was back then.
Yeah, well, I think with the war now, you can see that the U.S. and Israel have this connection. And so when you have Israel bombing Iran and now the U.S. is bombing Iran, I think that's definitely something to look at. And, you know, I think it's the whole connection between what's happening here in the U.S. with the harm on the immigrant community, the harm on the Palestinians, and now there's going to be harm to Iranians in that are going to be, you know, exposed to the bombings. Like, I just think that we're putting a lot of people at risk right now. We're harming a lot of vulnerable communities, and that's just something that is perpetuating settler colonialism and oppression that a lot of these marginalized communities are suffering because of these colonialists, these fascist decisions to make these calls.
Precisely. And another component to this that really I find problematic is, now Iranians, if they weren't already, going to be demonized the same way as Latinos right now. I mean, Los Angeles, if not the whole state of California, has one of the largest Iranian diasporas in the country as well, correct?
Right.
Yeah, so it's just an escalation not only to what's happening over there, but also an escalation to the demonization of people of color here in this country. And so, again, I don't want to leave this conversation entirely doom and gloom, but I do want to focus, you know, on the importance of youth in leading this charge. Because again, the older generation in Los Angeles, as you mentioned, are recognizing what young people are doing right now in Los Angeles as not necessarily a repetition, but a continuation and an enhancement to grassroots resistance that took place back in the 60s and even the 70s. But even then, you correctly pointed out in your Waging on Violence article that this rich history is not exclusive to what took place in the Zoot Suit riots back in the 30s and 40s, or the Chicano walkouts in the 60s. Even as recently as the 2000s, you know, back in March of 2006, you said there was a student walkout in support of immigrant rights. And I think we need to remind people that that was around the same time as the SB 1070 law in Arizona, the Show Me Your Papers law, that sparked outrage, not just in Arizona, but throughout the whole country as well. And so we're not talking about something that happened 30, 40, 50 years ago, but very recently in the history here in the U.S. And so I think it's important to note here and important to pontificate upon, because it also shows that we're not entirely far away from what took place in the 60s. You know, we're seeing it in real time in our lifetimes, correct?
Right, yes. There's this continuous resistance. As long as something's happening, there's going to be people fighting back. And that's just part of, you know, the resistance. There's a lot of activism here in Los Angeles and also across the country. I just think that there's a lot of grassroots activists, people who want to get involved, people who want to help the community. They're going to find each other. They're going to come together and they're going to strategize and come up with ways that they can fight against this repression, that they can uplift communities at the same time as they're fighting this repression. I've seen a lot of people not only taking to the streets to protest, but they've also been buying out street vendors, giving street vendors money so they don't have to go to the street if they're undocumented. They don't have to risk being
really
ICE. Yes, I've seen people buying groceries for people who are too afraid to leave their house. You know, like the Los Angeles community is really showing out for each other and they're helping each other, mutual aid. They're, you know, so in addition to protesting, there's also other things going on that people are doing.
See, I wasn't aware of that. That's quite interesting. It's almost like a indirect backhanded form of the pandemic in sort of a way, and having people stay at homes while other people, you know, take care of undocumented neighbors, essentially, correct?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. So I just want to make it clear that I'm going to create a link to both of these articles on our Twitter account so people can learn more about what you reported on and why these two articles, which you wrote in both January and February, are still relevant today. And so going to your Waging Nonviolence article, I'm curious to know, is there anything else from this article that you hope people learn with regards to the militarization of police and law enforcement over in Los Angeles and how people can push back on it and how you've seen people push back on it on the grassroots level?
Yeah, well, I think as long as this militarization does exist, like I said, there's going to be people fighting back. And so that's just, I think, the thing that I want people to take away the most, because I'm very big on resistance narratives and, you know, not just doom and gloom, but uplifting communities, empowering people to take action and not just, you know, if they're upset with something, you know, just kind of like sitting back, like, no, everybody has power to do something about what's going on right now, whether it's sharing stuff on social media so people, other people can see it, whether it's helping donate to families who have been impacted by the ICE raids, helping buy out street vendors, you know, buying groceries for people, going to these hotels where ICE is staying at and making noise. Like, I've seen people honking horns, bringing pots and pans, like bringing musical instruments and posting up outside of hotels ICE is staying at and just making noise till 3 a.m. just to prove a point, just so ICE won't sleep. You know, like there's people who are out here who are defending their communities in all different kinds of ways. And I think that everybody has the power to do something like that.
And just to tie both articles together, this is a lesson that I got from both of them combined, which is that, as you mentioned in your Real News Network article, is that there are millions, if not billions, of dollars being used for this interchange of training U.S. law enforcement by Israeli officials as a means to marginalize and demonize people of color here in this country. A lot of money is being invested on it. And unfortunately, we can see how those sort of training methods have manifested itself in places like Gaza, which has been a catastrophe for almost 2 years now, you know. But in the U.S., that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to work here. So long as there are youth and grassroots organizations in places like Los Angeles that have the will and the capacity to fight back against it. To what degree can they succeed? We don't know. It all depends on how much support they get from the general public and how much support they get from places outside of Los Angeles as well. So those are the lessons I got from your article. And I hope people who are listening to us today get the same lessons as well. So with that said, we've been speaking with Victoria Valenzuela. She's an independent journalist in California covering social justice and criminal justice issues. Her Real News Network article is entitled Deadly Exchange, U.S. Sends Hundreds of Law Enforcement Officials to Israel to Learn Worst Practices from IDF. Her second article for Waking Nonviolence is entitled Los Angeles is Leading the Way in Resisting Trump's Mass Deportations. And like I said before, we're going to create a link to both articles on our Twitter account so people can learn more. But in the meantime, Victoria Valenzuela, thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. That is @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
This July 4th, WPFW presents Higher, the poetic genius of Sekou Sundiata and the musical innovation of Sly Stone. From 9 a.m. until 7 p.m., we begin at 11 a.m. with an airing of Sekou Sundiata's 51st Dream State, a multimedia meditation on empire. At 1 p.m., our multifaceted exploration of Sly Stone kicks off until 7 p.m. with tributes curated by Brother Jamil, James Funk, and DJ Lance Reynolds. Full schedule at WPFWFM.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The WPFW Local Station Board's Relocation Committee is in the process of re-envisioning what studio space for a progressive, community-based, and community-supported radio station should be in the coming decade or more. We wish to ensure that a new, more permanent home will meet current needs and those less foreseeable in the future. All WPFW stakeholders, listeners, donors, programmers, staff, community activists may share their thoughts and insights about the future space by taking the location survey located on the WPFW homepage. Be creative in your answers. The future belongs to those who dream big. The survey may be found at www.wpfwfm.org. Please submit your answers by June 30th. Thank you for your thoughts and time.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. In Supreme Court news today, in a 6-3 ruling, the Supreme Court allowed President Trump's executive order ending birthright citizenship for the children of some immigrants to go into effect. The court did not weigh in on whether Trump's executive order is constitutional. What it did decide is that lower court judges lack the authority to grant nationwide injunctions. Numerous lawsuits have been filed in federal courts to block the executive order, and judges have uniformly ruled against the administration on constitutional grounds. The president has repeatedly complained about federal judges blocking his policies, claiming judges are abusing their power and are biased against him politically. And the Justice Department argued that those judges lack the power to give nationwide effect to their rulings, leading the dissent to today's ruling agreeing with the Trump administration. Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote that the majority played into the president's hand. Quote, "With the stroke of a pen, the president has made a solemn mockery of our Constitution. Rather than stand firm, the court gives way. Because such complicity should know no place in our system of law, I dissent." Close quote. In another major ruling today, the Supreme Court handed a preliminary victory to Montgomery County, Maryland parents who object for religious reasons to the school system's use of LGBTQ plus themed books in classrooms, saying parents should be allowed to opt their children out of such classes. The 6-3 ruling sent the case back to lower courts for a full hearing, but the majority left little doubt where it stands on the issue. In favor of the decision, Justice Samuel Alito wrote that the introduction of LGBTQ plus inclusive storybooks into the literature curriculum while denying opt-outs, quote, "places an unconstitutional burden on the parents' rights to the free exercise of their religion," close quote. Justice Sonia Sotomayor read a summary of her dissent from the bench on behalf of the three liberal justices. She said the court's ruling, quote, "strikes at the core premise of public schools, that children may come together to learn not the teachings of a particular faith, but a range of concepts and views that reflect our entire society," close quote. In other news, 5 days after the United States Air Force conducted strikes on Iranian nuclear installations, the exact extent of the damage remains unknown. WPFW's Noah Portner has more.
The Iranian enrichment centrifuges are extremely sensitive to vibrations, but are buried up to 300 feet underground, beyond the penetration depth of the bombs that were dropped. While President Trump asserts that the nuclear sites were entirely obliterated by the strikes, a leaked report by the Defense Intelligence Agency estimates only surface-level damage and reports that Iran will be able to get its nuclear program back on track within months. The status of the centrifuges is very hard to determine, given Iranian secrecy and a lack of satellite imagery. But some skeptics warn that the recent strikes are motivating Iran to quickly regenerate their program and develop nuclear weapons. In fact, the installations hit by the U.S. do not even need to be repaired in order for an operable nuclear bomb to be developed. Iran has enriched 400 kilograms of uranium to near weapons grade. The location of this uranium is unknown, with some sources reporting that they were removed and spirited away prior to the